Okay, so we're moving on to the next panel discussion. We've heard a lot about the care continuum during the course of this meeting, so this is a great opportunity to explore issues relating to the treatment cascade in more detail. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Professor Carlos Del Rio from the Emory School Medical School University. So welcome.
Thank you. And why don't we have the members of the two presenters and the members of the panel, we have a lot of group people in this panel, come up to the table. And what we're going to do is in this session, can I have the first slide, my slides, of optimizing our response to addressing gaps in the treatment cascade. We're going to have Dr. Merman first tell us about the testing issues, and then Jane Anderson will tell us about standards of care. But I wanted to take you back a little bit because this whole issue of the cascade actually was something that I first presented back in 2001 at a conference in Croy. I had an abstract, and I did an oral presentation about what I thought was the challenge of going from undiagnosis to undetectable in the inner city in the United States. And I did this little pyramid, and what I did that we didn't have in the treatment cascade, I actually said there are 5 million people engaging in behaviors that put them at risk of HIV, which percent of the population. I went all the way down. And I said that this was about, I thought that about, at that point in time, 10% of those living with HIV were virologically suppressed. Well, I sent this to several journals and got my ass kicked, basically, saying that this was ridiculous, that didn't make any sense, and essentially didn't get published. Well, you know, it took 10 years. But 10 years later, we finally got this published. We just put a different format into this. And at that point in time, we said, well, it's not 10%. It's more like 19%. So in 10 years, we made a 9% improvement. But what one figure that strikes me about this whole thing, about the treatment cascade, is when we published that paper in 2011, we did this simulation. And what this, and I thought this was the graph that was going to get the most attention, not the other one in the paper. And it turns out nobody has paid much attention to this one. And basically what it says here is that you have 19% suppressed here. And if you diagnose 90%, if you do simple things, diagnose 90% or engage 90% or treat 90% or get virologically undetectable 90%, that's the numbers that you get suppressed. And if you do all of them at 90%, you only get 66% of the population suppressed. So you still have about 34% that are not suppressed, emphasizing the need for prevention. So I want to say that as much as we're going to talk about improving the treatment cascade, I want people not to forget the prevention component of it. Treatment is not going to get us out of this. I think we still need to work treatment and prevention together. So with that said, let me introduce our first speaker. Dr. Jonathan Merriman is the newly appointed director of the National Center for HIV, TB, STD, and viral hepatitis. I think you don't have influenza and a couple other diseases, but everything else is his. And at the U.S. Center for Disease Control. And he is somebody who I think has brought, from the very beginning of his time at CDC, has really brought care into prevention. And I would tell you that this is a huge Chinese wall that exists between care and treatment in the United States. And Dr. Merman has done everything possible to try to break it down. And I think it's really fantastic to have him in that position. So welcome, John.
Thank you, Carlos. You know, my assigned task was to present in the implementation of HIV testing in the United States. And I will do that, but in direct protest of limiting my vision, I'll also discuss some opportunities along the entire continuum of care. So I'll start with a quick overview of the HIV epidemic, then ask what we should do now with changing times in HIV, provide some programmatic and policy examples, and then present conclusions. The HIV epidemic continues to be a major public health problem in the United States, and it's growing. Today, about 1.2 million people are living with HIV, and the number of persons living with HIV, shown in red, has increased 60% in the past 15 years. Each year, there are about 50,000 new infections and about 20,000 deaths among people living with HIV, a net increase of 30,000 people with HIV each year. This is good news, since it reflects improved diagnosis and care. However, it presents a challenge for prevention because stable incidence and effective treatment results in an increasing number of people with HIV who have the potential to transmit the virus to others. So this issue is highlighted in this graph that shows the HIV transmission rate in the orange triangles, defined as the estimated annual number of new HIV infections per 100 persons living with HIV. It's the ultimate surveillance indicator for monitoring the prevention effects of test and treat. The transmission rate has declined 89% since the mid-1980s, from 31 to 4, reflecting the combined impact of prevention, testing, and treatment. Since 1997, the transmission rate has dropped by about one-third, even though HIV incidence has been stable, emphasizing the urgency of prevention, as every year the transmission rate has to decrease just to maintain stable incidence, let alone reduce the epidemic below its effective reproductive rate. In addition, it's not possible to understand the HIV epidemic in the U.S. without appreciating that HIV is the quintessential health example of inequity. African Americans are 8 times more likely, and Latinos are 3 times more likely to have HIV than white Americans. These disparities are highlighted among women. For example, the number of women estimated to be diagnosed with HIV in her lifetime ranges from about 1 in 32 for African American women to 1 in 526 white or Asian women. HIV prevalence is actually associated with population density, region of residence, poverty, education, employment, and homelessness. In addition, men who have sex with men are more than 40 times more likely to have HIV than other men or women. And in the U.S., as in many countries, there are major geographic disparities. Diagnoses range from 2.6 per 100,000 in Montana to 37 per 100,000 in Louisiana, 15 times higher rates. So these data are a clarion call for rapid effort, because faster action now saves lives and resources later. The model data here presented shows with the first line in orange the current situation in the U.S., indicating with stable incidence, in 10 years, there'd be an additional 550,000 infections. The blue line shows that if we reduce incidence by 25% over 10 years, we would prevent 62,000 infections and save the healthcare system $23 billion. But if we reduce incidence by 25% over 5 years, per the U.S. National HIV-AIDS Strategy, as shown in green, then we would avert 109,000 infections and save $42 billion. So what do we do now? Well, first, I recognize that there are challenging times for HIV prevention currently. The federal U.S. deficit was $1.1 trillion in fiscal year 2012. There's a 3-year freeze on federal discretionary funding, and there have been several years of reductions in public health services, with a loss of 46,000 state and local positions, and many community organizations are closed or struggling. But at the same time, there have been new scientific breakthroughs, and the Affordable Care Act is expanding coverage to tens of thousands of people with HIV who were previously prevented from accessing insurance due to having a pre-existing health condition, and millions of people at risk for HIV infection. So to best use the opportunities presented to us along with restricted budgets, we need to apply the science of implementation to choosing, mixing, and maximizing impact. And this slide on high-impact prevention represents a flow from thought to action. For each potential intervention, we need to assess its efficacy from randomized controlled trials or structured studies, and ideally its effectiveness in uncontrolled real-life circumstances, which could be different. For example, for condoms, the best-case scenario for efficacy is 94% reduction in acquisition of HIV, but its user effectiveness rate is about 80%. It's necessary to consider economics. Since we have limited resources, maximizing prevention means achieving the lowest cost per infection averted or quality-adjusted life year saved. We should determine the feasibility of full-scale implementation, since interventions need to be at a sufficient scale. For example, a trial of 5 2-hour behavioral counseling sessions among African-American women increased condom use, but the target population is several million. We should develop epidemic models to project the impact of interventions together. For example, implementing CDC's testing guidelines combined with expanded ART would conservatively prevent 17% of new infections at $21,000 per quality-adjusted life year saved. And based on all this analysis, we should prioritize the interventions that will have ultimately the greatest impact and implement and evaluate these programs. And I feel the need to stop here and mention that the state of science for interventions along the continuum of care is abysmal. There's been only one randomized controlled trial of linkage to care and one randomized controlled trial of retention in care. There are more options for HIV adherence, but if we are to treat implementation seriously, we need to greatly increase the number and efficacy of evidence-based options. So to implement high-impact prevention, economic models are necessary. Here in this slide are preliminary models and costs per infection averted for prevention interventions by risk group. On the top are interventions such as testing in clinical settings, partner services, linkage to care, and adherence, typically delivered to all patients with HIV. On the bottom are interventions such as testing in non-clinical settings, behavioral interventions for HIV-positive individuals, and behavioral interventions for HIV-negative individuals typically targeted by risk group. Testing of men who have sex with men in non-clinical settings was the lowest cost at about $18,000 per infection averted. Behavioral interventions for uninfected heterosexuals at high risk of infection ranked last, costing more than $15 million per case averted. And new interventions such as PrEP need to be modeled too. Our preliminary data suggests PrEP is roughly $170 million in cost per infection averted for heterosexuals and $700,000 averted for MSM, highlighting the need for targeting PrEP to very high-risk people, improving adherence, and ultimately lowering the cost of medication. Please note that because the lifetime cost for HIV care in the U.S. is $400,000, PrEP for MSM is less than $100,000 per quality-adjusted life year, well within the normal cost-effectiveness threshold, but more expensive per outcome than several other interventions. So I'd like to touch on some program and policy examples. In 2012, we began implementing the first year of a five-year HIV prevention funding cycle for health departments that revised the way that CDC allocates core HIV prevention funds, about $339 million awarded annually. It's now allocated on each jurisdiction's HIV prevalence, and it allows for flexibility based on local epidemic modeling and needs. But the program requires that health departments focus on interventions that will have the greatest impact on the epidemic, and jurisdictions must spend 75% of their budget mainly focused on HIV testing and prevention with positives, including ART. This program allowed many health departments to dramatically change their portfolios, stopping many activities previously supported by CDC and starting new ones. So HIV prevention is the linchpin of prevention and treatment and should be the entry point into the medical care system for people with HIV. And this slide shows about 200,000 or 18% of people with HIV are currently unaware of their infection. 32% of persons diagnosed with HIV are diagnosed with AIDS concurrently or within 1 year of HIV diagnosis, indicating several years of relatively high viral load and sexual activity without knowledge of status, supporting estimates that one half of new HIV transmissions come from this group. Without expanded and improved testing, we're doomed to failure. But we have some programmatic successes. The Veteran Administration revised its national HIV policy to routinely offer HIV testing to all veterans. And historically, in 2009, when the policy went into effect, it removed the previous requirement for written informed consent and pre- and post-test counseling. In 2009, 9% of outpatients had ever been tested. By 2011, this had increased to 20%, representing 1.2 million more people tested. Successful programs can also occur outside the healthcare setting. Last year, the Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Center had 3.4% diagnosed of 1,200 people tested, and 95% of them were linked to care within 3 months. And testing in the real world is cost-effective. In the first 3 years of CDC's expanded testing initiative, 2.8 million tests were conducted. 18,000 people were newly diagnosed with HIV, 70% of whom were African-American and 12% Latino. And it was estimated that about 3,400 HIV infections were averted, averting $1.1 billion in direct medical costs and achieving a return on investment of about $2 for every dollar spent. And we are improving. The percentage of people with HIV with undiagnosed infections, shown in the green triangles, decreased substantially in the first 2 decades of the epidemic, with slower progress more recently, dropping from 30% in 1995 to 25% in 2003 to 18% in 2009. Why? It gets harder as people who regularly seek care or get tested for HIV are diagnosed, and we increasingly need to find people who either have recent infection, who are never or irregularly tested. So, for example, about 1 in 20 tests conducted with CDC funds were positive in the late 1980s, and in 2010, 1 of 100 tests were positive. So as many speakers have emphasized, testing's not enough. To do better along the continuum of care, we need to merge the goals of clinical medicine and public health. Clinical care tends to focus on the inner circles presented here, patients prescribed ART or regularly receiving care. Public health focuses on the outer circles, all people with HIV, whether diagnosed or not. And we need to increase the scope of responsibility of all parties so the public health system monitors outcomes such as viral suppression and holds the care system accountable. And clinics strive to improve the quality of care, including preventive care, for a larger scope of patients. So this is exemplified by viral load measures. As Julio emphasized yesterday, we need to monitor programs. But what that means depends on definitions. Most clinicians focus on what we call monitored viral load, essentially values from patients who come to the clinic and have viral load measurements. Some people report in-care viral load, including all people in regular care, and assuming the people who did not have a viral load measured were detectable. Public health is increasingly interested in community viral load, which includes people who have been diagnosed but are not in care. But I'd like to posit that the standard for public health should be population viral load, because we fool ourselves if we don't include people with HIV who have not been diagnosed in our denominator, especially when they are responsible for at least half of all transmissions in any country that has ever made estimates. Now, none of this is possible without universal reporting of all CD4 counts and viral loads. No one, no person, no city, no country is capable of calculating an accurate continuum of care without having required reporting of all CD4 cell counts and viral loads, or access to all medical records in your jurisdiction, because you won't know if people were linked to care after diagnosis, if they fell out of care, or what their viral load is. And if laboratory values are not reported, then you end up reporting a false continuum of care, a misguided, dangerous version that only includes people who have been recently seen in care, essentially in-care viral load. The only exception is in countries with generalized epidemics who conduct AIDS indicator surveys with viral load testing, and there have been only two. So CDC provides resources to health jurisdictions to support the implementation and maintenance of electronic lab reporting for all HIV-related test results, including CD4 counts and viral loads, and 64% of states currently require all laboratory values to be reported, and hopefully that will increase each year. So when we estimate our continuum of care, it's important to monitor whether we're equitably reaching all people with HIV. This slide shows drops along the continuum that are different by race and ethnicity. And we see substantial differences by age, with youth less likely to be prescribed ART and consequently less likely to have a suppressed viral load, probably because physicians did not prescribe it to them due to previous CD4 cell count restrictions. Although U.S. guidelines have rightfully recommended ART for all people with HIV, regardless of immune status, for at least 2 years. So high-impact surveillance starts with the need for health departments implementing policies for CD4 and viral load reporting, enhancing reporting from laboratories, ensuring reporting from healthcare providers, and providing feedback to providers and patients on outcomes, and lastly, implementing integrated security and confidentiality policies and overseeing the process by the health departments, healthcare providers, and patients, ultimately. We can't stop there. We also have an obligation to provide data back to grantees if we're going to improve implementation. And at CDC, we collect semi-annual data from funded partners, including a few indicators and easily understood reports, and provide the feedback to grantees about their progress with direct comparison to the goals of the program and to other grantees. At the same time that we initiated these, we also reduced reporting burden and frequency of reporting by 25% to 30% because we wanted to focus on the information we really needed. So in this slide, I show a page from the most recent example of a program that funds 34 organizations working with young MSM and transgender people of color. We focused on only three outcomes: HIV testing, linkage to care, and HIV testing, proportion positive, and linkage to care, although the grantees are also funded to do some other activities. And the vertical black lines are the required goals in the funding announcement. And although this is the first year, and there are startup costs and delays that really lower some of the outcomes in the first year, you can see that a number of organizations were doing an exemplary job, and a large proportion are currently receiving extra attention for corrective action. So in my last slide, I just wanted to emphasize that this is a time of reduced resources and new opportunities, and it requires change. Improving outcomes along the continuum of care can be highly cost-effective, and doing a good job requires expanded responsibilities for both public health and clinical care, and the need to monitor outcomes and use the information to improve the quality of programs.
Thank you, John. Our next speaker is Dr. Jane Anderson. Dr. Anderson is a senior advisor on sexual health and HIV in Public Health England, and she's the past chair of the British HIV Association. Her book on standards of care for persons living with HIV is excellent, and if you don't have one, get one at the coffee break. They're right there. So.
Thank you very much for that introduction. I've got a copy of the standards, and it's actually produced by a whole committee of the British HIV Association. So I've entitled my talk, Mind the Gap, and I come to this very much as a clinician, and I'm trying to think what it is in clinical care that can advance the cascade. And we've talked a huge amount in the last couple of days about global challenges, and I'm going to talk from the perspective of a UK physician being in the privileged and highly lucky position to work in the global north, in a society that supports free treatment and care at the point of need to whoever needs it. And yet, even in this environment, 42% of people living with HIV are potentially infectious, even with the resources that we've got here and now. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about where we may move that treatment cascade as clinicians. I'm going to bring you a real-life example of a tool in terms of the standards. And I want to talk at the beginning that I intend to talk about treatment as opposed to drugs. And we've talked a lot about treatment as prevention, and I think what we've been talking about is drugs as prevention. And I want to suggest that as clinicians, we have other tools in our armamentarium apart from drugs, and of course drugs and efficacious drugs are crucial, but they are not of themselves enough alone. So let's start off with thinking about treatment for people who don't have HIV. And I would suggest that this is a gap. And if we think about the discussions particularly we've had this morning, I put out that question to you. Do people who test negative get the right support from their clinical teams to remain negative? And one of the previous discussants at the last panel pointed out that there is a substantial cost of HIV testing. And the vast majority of people who take an HIV test in my privileged global north position test negative. And I would suggest that at the moment we as clinicians are not maximising our efficacy on what we might be doing in terms of treatment for people who are negative. If you take treatment to include good advice, regular follow-up and a number of other interventions. And what does treatment support for people who are HIV-free look like? Well, that will differ depending on whether you're in a serodifferent relationship, whether you are in a group considered to be at high risk of acquiring HIV. And so the interventions that we as clinicians might wish to begin to mobilise need to be tailored to the people who are accessing our services. And I would also suggest, particularly in the UK, where we are making a huge thrust to roll out HIV testing, as we have just heard, to normalise HIV testing, that means putting HIV testing into the hands of people who don't know necessarily about PrEP, who don't necessarily know all the advice that they should be giving about safer sex, and perhaps home testing kits into the hands of people who may not even go on to access care. I leave that as a question and a huge gap about what are the HIV-related treatment needs of people who are HIV negative, and I flag it up as a gap. I wondered about a PrEP cascade. What we're going to have to find out in due course is how many people who test negative for HIV will go on, ultimately, to acquire HIV, and how many of those might have been avoiding acquiring HIV had they had access to PrEP. And I'm not sure how we're going to necessarily get that data, because what we're seeing in our clinics are people who have HIV who come and tell us they've had a previous test. We do not see all the people who've tested to find out what their long-term outcomes are. And I suggest that there may well be another set of gaps that will follow from that. But let's think a little bit more about treatment for people who do have HIV. And as I've said, treatment may or may not include antiretroviral drugs. And I think this is really important. And people who are using antiretroviral drugs, for whatever reason they are choosing to use them, have got very specific and particular treatment needs. And we have got some very good information about people who take treatment for the good of other people, and that is pregnant women. And we know very clearly in the UK at the moment that a significant number of women take antiretroviral therapy for short periods of time. They start, they stop. Now, that may be changing as the guidelines change, and certainly we're not in an option B country as other places in the world are. And we are still beginning to see how people manage when they're using short-term therapy for the good of other people. And the other gap that we have at the moment is that we don't know nearly as much about the outcomes for people who start therapy at higher CD4 counts in the UK. My colleague Valerie Delpech, who's going to be speaking in the next session, who monitors these sorts of questions, I've actually posed her the question, how many people in the UK who start HIV therapy at a CD4 count above 350 do we know have got an undetectable viral load? And we don't know where that gap is, although Valerie has certainly got some insights into it. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the tool that we produced to try and look at how we maximise the treatment opportunities for people living with HIV. And I was privileged to be the chair of the British HIV Association at a time when we began to face a significant policy shift in the health economy of the United Kingdom. And we felt that it was an important moment to develop standards of what good care looked like. And we were very lucky to be funded by the MacAIDS Foundation, and we had a collaborative effort between providers, commissioners, people living with HIV, and NGOs, and a range of stakeholders to do that. And so what are the advantages of actually making some standards in this setting? Well, we wanted to describe what good care looks like. And I emphasise, in the UK in 2013. So it isn't necessarily reproducible or wouldn't necessarily look the same in other settings. It means everybody knows what's expected. It means that we've actually got outcomes, and we focus the document on outcomes and measures and indicators. And we couldn't find measures and indicators for everything, but that was the intention. And we looked very hard to make it as adaptable as possible, because we know a number of new providers are coming into the UK English health economy. And so we looked at goals rather than routes to those goals. Where do we want to get to? There may be six routes to getting there, but where are we aiming at? That we had auditable outcomes, we had measurable outcomes, and that we could try and find ways to identify when the standards were being met. So who do we expect to be reading them and looking at them? We hope very much that service providers involved in the care of people living with HIV would want to use them to know what they should be doing. And we wanted commissioners, who have all changed on the 1st of April this year, who have responsibility for purchasing care for people living with HIV, to know what they should be buying. And most particularly, we wanted people living with HIV to know what they ought to be able to expect to get and what their care should look like. We've emphasised a single system approach, and this, I guess, is the continuum of care, but looking at testing and diagnosis, linking and retention, treating and caring for people, the support needs that people living with HIV have in terms of care, and then monitoring, measuring, and remembering research. And this is a very nice, smooth system here. I've coloured it in nice blocks that merge nicely, and I would just alert you that from the 1st of April, these have been now divided in the way that they are purchased, so that testing and diagnosis is now paid for separately from treatment and care. So although it looks like a continuum, in terms of commissioning, it's separating itself out. So very quickly, let me give you some examples how this might address the gaps, because I know time is short. We've got 12 standards, and the first five are really very specific about HIV diagnosis and clinical care. And if I give you the first one, and I haven't done the whole cascade, I'm just... Oh, gosh, that hasn't come out quite right. Sorry. That hasn't, the formatting's gone a bit pear-shaped. I'm concentrating here on the gap. So let's take the first gap, which is in the UK, of 100 people knowing that 100 people living with HIV, only 77 are diagnosed. And if we look at our own clinician data, this is the British HIV Association audit of our own clinicians. They told us in 2010 that of over 1,000 people who pitched up into HIV clinics in the UK, 52% had a baseline CD4 count below 350. 30% of those people had presented with clinical symptoms of HIV infection, and 25% of them had had a missed opportunity. And this is when they are walking into a clinical setting and meeting a doctor. This isn't people who are accessing community testing sites. This is clinical care in the UK. I'm washing our dirty linen in public, but it's important. And so we wrote Standard 1, and we said that people who are attending healthcare services, primary, secondary, tertiary, should be offered diagnostic tests in accordance with current national guidelines. Because we've got fabulous national guidelines telling you how you should be approaching testing, but they're not being implemented. And so Standard 1 is let's implement the guidelines. What about access to retention and care? Because that's the second gap that we have in the treatment cascade. Now, in the UK, our gap is really relatively small. Of the people who are diagnosed, about 73% are actually retained in care. So we are quite pleased with that, but we felt it was very important that we actually said, what does good retention and access look like? And so we've said that anybody who is newly diagnosed with HIV infection should meet somebody at the earliest opportunity and should definitely not wait more than 2 weeks before they are engaged in care. And if they have symptoms and signs associated with HIV, that should be 24 hours before they meet somebody who has expertise in that condition. And that services, whoever provides them, must have some mechanism for noticing when people don't come back and for following them up and for checking where they've got to. And so we've actually explicitly made a standard for that gap. The next bit is much more complicated, I think, because we know that within the clinic, of the people retained in care, a majority are on antiretroviral therapy because they present with low CD4 counts. But there are people who choose not to take therapy or who don't take therapy or a whole variety of reasons. And so that led us to write a standard about how antiretroviral should be prescribed with properly qualified people, that they should be properly monitored, and that they should follow national guidelines. And, of course, we've got very robust guidelines, again, produced by the British HIV Association, which I'll remind you of. We still recommend that people start at a CD4 count of 350, and I was in the audience to hear about the question about whether CD4 counts are valid or not, but this is still our UK guideline. And we recommend that every single person who comes into HIV care has a conversation about treatment as prevention, and should they wish to take treatment for that reason, they should be allowed and have access to do so. So the people who are actually on therapy with an undetectable viral load. Now, this is where things have gone go down, and this is where the issue of treatment for me comes absolutely to the fore. Because actually, it isn't just about prescribing drugs. And I think over the last 2.5 days, repeatedly, we've heard over and over and over again all the other elements of care that we have to provide. And I've called these HIV critically related issues, and these are the things to make sure that people get mental, emotional, cognitive well-being as it relates to HIV, that we have access to the STEP model of care for psychological support, that we can promote good sexual health. So I would suggest that even though 42% of people living with HIV in the UK have a detectable viral load, that does not mean to say that they are all transmitting HIV, because they're in good care, meeting health advisors, having access to condoms, having access to partner notification, and all the treatment and support that they need to do that. Good screening for STI is absolutely fundamental, and for people who want to start families, having the right information to do that safely. And increasingly, I think it's terribly important that we have access to support, to self-management, and for service user engagement. And we've suggested that this should be absolutely central to everything that is happening in the clinical setting, that there should be access for support for physical problems, social problems, peer support, self-management, and the non-clinical care provision, which allows people, and in the UK at the moment, we have people who are very poor, who maybe don't have adequate housing, who don't have jobs, for whom HIV may not be top of their list of priorities. There are many other things in their lives that are causing them difficulties with adherence and taking their therapy. And I would suggest, just after our last speaker, the NGO sector in this country is also facing financial issues, and I don't know how much that is going to impact. And a crucial thing, which I think has come through time and time again in the last couple of days, is that people living with HIV must be fundamentally engaged in all parts of their own care, making decisions about what it looks like and how it works. And we've put in a whole section about knowledge, that people should have the right competencies, information sharing, absolutely crucial, and that everybody who provides care collects the data that you've talked about. So that's all very jolly, fine and nice, and we've presented it, and we've written the book, and we've handed it. How are we going to make this happen? How are we going to implement this and actually see results? We want to absolutely emphasise a whole system approach, and for the first time now we have a national service specification for HIV. We have something that we maybe can use to hold people. We have a quality dashboard, we have incentivised payments for doing well, we're beginning to look at cheaper ways to procure antiretrovirals, clinicians are being paid by outcomes, we have new data sets that Valerie's going to talk about, and we have a very robust national audit programme. Patient-related outcome measures are crucial, but we don't have those yet. We're working on those. And we have a number of new structures where we can engage people. Very quickly, a few ideas for closing the gaps. Crucial to have a person-centred approach, whatever it is we do, that we have a whole system approach. Efficacious drugs aren't enough. What works? How does it work? And why does it work? And what can we replicate? That we close the academic and intellectual gaps, some of which we've heard about in the last 2 days. The crucial role of leadership. People living with HIV actually being able and empowered to be able to put things forward. Making sure that people are not complacent, that we have visibility, that we have resource. And we will have to argue for it, and we'll have to work smarter. But we have to make sure we've got this as resource and stamina for the long haul. Because as Mike Cohen said yesterday, failure isn't an option.
Thank you very much. So we now have 6 discussants. I'm not going to present them because if I do, we'll run out of time. They're going to do a variant of Twitter, I guess. They're going to have their comments made very briefly, but very substantive. And I ask them for about 3 minutes. And each one of them, you can see in their program what they're talking about. So just go along, start. And whoever wants to start is perfectly fine.
Should I start?
John.
Okay, I'm Jane Bruton. I'm from the National HIV Nurses Association. And just want to say 3 points, really, from a nursing perspective. I think the first thing, obviously, we've talked about linkage of care and retention in care. I think one of the key things is to enable patients to stay within care, which will be critical in terms of prevention and ongoing well-being of patients, is the attitude of the people who are providing that care and the competence. And I think that's something that we need to really think about, because obviously we're still dealing with a stigmatised disease, and attitude and the way that people are treated within services. We know globally and locally that can put people off coming, and we lose them to care. And I think that's something that we really need to think about when we're thinking about task shifting. So when we shift those tasks, are those people educated enough to be able to be competent at what they're doing, but also to have the right attitude and not stigmatise the people that they're managing? And I think that's also true for us in the UK when we're thinking about shifting some of the care into primary care. There are difficulties with our patients face with general practitioners or with practice nurses about the attitude that they have to patients, and that is critical if we're going to keep people in care. I think the second point I wanted to make is I came into HIV care as a nurse because of the opportunity to provide holistic care. I came at a time when nursing care was divided into tasks. So you were a bowel nurse, a nurse who washed the patient, a nurse who took the observations. And we theoretically thought that individualized, holistic patient care was much better option for a patient, better care, better delivery. And that coming into HIV was that opportunity to provide holistic patient care, patient-centered care, and being able to develop a partnership with the patient, and also working in a multidisciplinary team where there was a flattened hierarchy. And I think that is what we've learnt as nurses, and work very closely with our medical and other colleagues in the healthcare system, to be able to continue that approach. Because all of the issues that have been raised by Jane and the other speaker was about the things that impact on patients' well-being that are beyond the medications, the psychosocial issues, the problems with drug addiction, the problems with alcohol. All of those things mean you have to have an individualised approach to care. And that's one of the key things that I think I've learned. And I think that through that, we've developed tools within HIV that can address some of these gaps and some of the problems but are based on holistic patient care. And I think we need to take those tools forward, so we've been able to adapt the care that we give in the context of the fact that we need to be better at providing adherence care, looking at case management, looking at peer support, and how we support patients, how we support peer support to support other patients, and how we support patients to self-manage. Because self-management doesn't just happen on its own. It requires that level of support. And that means, again, that very much that patient-centred care. So I think those are the three points that I want to make.
Thank you. That was terrific. Diane?
Thank you. I'm Diane Rausch, the Director of AIDS Research at the National Institute of Mental Health, which is one of the components of NIH, and we work closely with the other NIH institutes to develop research programs and fund research. So I have two major areas to discuss. Just want to say first that we've heard a lot about the cascade and a lot about the drop-off rates along the cascade, and there's a lot of research that needs to be done to figure out how to decrease that drop-off and keep people in care, and we really need to address each stage of the cascade. But I want to, with respect to treatment as prevention, I want to talk a little bit about getting people into care who are HIV positive but healthy and high CD4 counts, and this is a new area. The guidelines will probably be changing, and we really have to ask, to what degree will these HIV-positive individuals who have never been sick and with good CD4 counts, why will they start ART? And we talked about it has to be a voluntary decision. Having availability of ART is not necessarily a reason to that people will uptake it. So we need to know why they would do it. We need to give the message why it's clinically important, why there are clinical benefits. This is a different message that we've been giving HIV-positive patients for a long time. So there's a real provider need here that they establish these relationships and convey the message to the patients that's really to their benefit. It's not just altruistic to prevent spreading it, but it's also to their own benefit. We heard a little bit yesterday about the fact that the clinical pharmacology is changing. It's a very dynamic environment. There are new and improved drugs on the horizon, long-acting with improved toxicology profiles. So perhaps making the decision to go on to ART is not a life-changing event. It's not a lifelong event that perhaps down the road and not too far away, they won't have to take everyday pills, but we don't know that yet. So when an individual initiates ART, it is, for all intents and purposes right now, to be a lifelong event. So we need to understand this better, and we need to make sure that people understand why they need to make that decision, why we want them to make their decision, and we need to give them the support necessary to keep them. And we really don't know what kind of adherence problems they will have, but those need to be addressed too. So the only other point I would make is that the other gap in the cascade, I think, is at the end, at the far end. So we see drop-off at all stages, and we've had not a lot of interventions, but a lot of research has been done in the early stages, getting people tested, linked to care, and adhering to care. But our long-term studying of these patients hasn't really been more than 3, 4, 5 years. And if we're asking people to stay on ART for life What about down the road? What about patients who are on ART for 8-10 years? How do we keep them in care? What are, and Jane talked about this a little bit, what are the, and Jean, what are the factors that we can build in? How do we engage them into taking responsibility for their own care? For their own care? How many times do they have to go to the clinic? What are the clinical parameters that need to be addressed, and how often? People may think they're engaged in care because they think they're doing fine, but they haven't seen their provider in 1 or 2 years. So what are the parameters of retention and care, and how do we define those, and what are the research efforts that we need to do to get those so that we can do them effectively and efficiently? So that's those are my 2 points.
Thank you, Diane. That was great. Okay. Andrew?
Thanks. My name is Andrew Amato. I'm the newly appointed head of the HIV, STI, and hepatitis program in the European CDC. Permit me just a second. I'm still reeling from my colleague in the American CDC. One of his slides showed that my budget is 300 times less than his. Only my denominator is twice his, which is I'm still trying to recover. But I'll come to a few points that I have here on the point of cascade. Our remit in European CDC is a little different from what you've heard so far. We mainly focus on risk assessment and monitoring the risk, in other words, more the epidemiological side. And we have a role in monitoring and evaluation of programs, and that includes national programs, and that includes treatment and rollout of ART in national programs. And it might seem that it's an easy task because most of you are thinking, when you think EU, European Union, you think of UK, you think of the Netherlands, Germany. When I think of the EU, I think of Bulgaria, Romania, Latvia, Estonia. And in these countries, this is a real problem. I mean, you think the UK have problems, you should see these countries. So we have been looking at metrics, we have been looking at indicators that we can use. We've published a number of monitoring reports. We have something called the Dublin Declaration, which we monitor closely. And I'll just come to, I had quite a few issues I wanted to raise. I'll just come to one of these indicators we've been struggling with, which on the face of it looks quite simple. But when you think about, again, the broader European Union, in other words, the weaker countries, linkage to care or retention in care, a metric to measure that applies across the whole of the European Union. I know we've been really struggling with that one. And if any of you have any bright ideas, please find me in the coffee break. I'll be happy to hear them.
Thank you. That was great. Jean.
I'll be very brief. Just to address a few points, especially when it comes to the step in the cascade in terms of monitoring adherence or improving adherence. I think we all know that we don't have really a gold standard to monitor adherence, but as if we really want to be serious addressing the cascade, we need to try to master at least one or two monitoring tools. We know we have self-report, pharmacy refill, pill count, monitoring with electronic device. None of those monitoring tools have been validated, but at least we've been able to show that there is some that are very reliable, pharmacy refill or, for example, pill count. When they are very well done, they can be very helpful. And currently, we are trying to even combine a few tools to try to increase sensitivity of detecting viral load breakthrough. I think this is an ongoing, area of research, how to improve on monitoring those tools so you can proactively detect it or predict people going to fail so you can engage them in some adherence intervention. As far as adherence intervention are concerned, I think we've been able to make quite great progress on proving there is evidence-based intervention. We published it in the Annals last year, IAPAC panel. Few are targeted counseling, mobile phone technology, regimen simplification, and the use of community health worker supporter, treatment supporter. I think we are also coming in an era where we need to try to evaluate combining those intervention one to two and see how we can improve effectiveness of, improving adherence in our patients. I will just finish by trying to highlight key population where we currently try to prioritize adherence intervention, and those are population being neglected, pregnant women, adolescent and children, men who have sex with men, commercial sex worker, which have been key population in this conference being highlighted. They're still quite the foci of the epidemic. So I will stop there, but I think those are the points I wanted to make.
Thank you very much. Ben?
First, I wanted to thank this very august panel for joining us and sharing their thoughts. I'm actually also remarking that we've managed to do this all on time, despite the number of very smart people who want to have their voices heard. I very much appreciate Jono and Jane's presentations of cascades, and I actually want to emphasize, as others have here, that it's really important that we think of cascades as an important both national and jurisdictional metric. So whether your jurisdiction is one patient or a nation or a continent, without that, we don't know how we're doing. But I want to dissect cascade, because we were tasked with looking at how do we address these gaps. And I want to give you a metaphor, or at least propose a metaphor, that a cascade is a collection of rocks, and each rock is a barrier to or impedes the forward progress. So as we think about each step in the cascade, understand that each step is a composite of multiple steps or multiple barriers, and each barrier imposes a rate-determining barrier to the forward progress or the reverse of that. So therefore, the interventions that we apply to each of those steps is going to be, by definition, an aggregate of interventions. And moreover, from the perspective of IAPAC, that each of those steps probably requires a different human resource to solve those steps. And so, and in fact, I think we've mentioned the phrase of preaching to the choir. I think that we need to preach far outside the choir. We need to preach past the congregation. In fact, we need to preach outside of the church. Because, in fact, those solutions frequently will come from people and human resources that we've not yet reached. It's also important to understand, and Julio has published on this, that the rate-determining barriers will change over time. So as interventions change, as therapies change, as stigma changes, and hopefully someday magically disappears, that what becomes rate-determining in this process will also change, and therefore the human personnel necessary to achieve those goals will also change. And one last point, that while we typically think about this as a community-based or national-based, population-based problem, that individuals in that cascade may represent individual molecules of water cascading over those rocks and over those individual steps. So what goes for the population or community may not go for the individual. So we need to be, and this, I think, Jane, you mentioned this about being very individualized while we're still thinking of the macro problem. So I think that this is going to require a lot of head thumping and breaking down some barriers and thinking about things outside of the box and outside of the congregation. And I'm very encouraged to hear the kinds of conversations that we've had here, because I think we can move that rock forward. Thanks.
Thank you. Christine.
Last but not least, I have the job to carry you through 26 years of the journey of the organization I work for, TASO, and carry you back in the last final minute to take you through where we are at right now. TASO started as a peer support group, and I'd like to recognize Noreen, the founder of TASO, who mobilized this peer group of 17. Noreen, if you could stand up for recognition. So what I'm talking about, peer education, really started at the conception of this organization 26 years ago. So fast track now, 26 years later, as we are talking about treatment cascade and what needs to be done, the lessons that started TASO, the support when there was nothing at that point, it was all about peer support and hope over nothing, but just hold on for the next day, for the next minute, for the next hour, and that's what grown TASO over the last 26 years. So what are we doing today, and what are the lessons we've learned? As we look at the cascade, in terms of mobilizing people into testing, We have drama groups, people who are living with HIV/AIDS and have decided that for what they have got and the life that they've got back, they've got to reach out to others and tell them that you've got to test. So there are people who are mobilizing communities to come out and do their testing. And over and beyond the testing, then into initiation, into care, there are challenges there that we have noted in the cascade. And still, it is these people and others that have various names. We have linkages, facilitators, and name it, depending on what the program is. If it's EMTCT, the mentor mothers, they're reaching out to each other and supporting each other and carrying each other along the cascade and encouraging them to go through all the steps. And when they fall and when they feel like they're weak, it's still their support, peer supporters, that come to them and tell them, look here, we can't afford to give up at this stage. We've come so far, and we owe it to everybody that has been in this fight to make sure that we are successful, because our success spells life for the next generation of people that need this treatment. So we do have those in the system, and they have various names. We have community drug distribution agents who are carrying out refills to each other. After in chronic care, you can't afford having everybody coming back to the clinic monthly to get their drugs. So we have people who have taken it upon themselves as a responsibility to fetch their colleagues and peers' drugs and distribute it, and they know that the lives of their peers depend on this. So, of course, it does have challenges, and like Alan pointed out, how are we making sure that we are not just taking these people's contribution for granted? And we are mobilizing and advocating with government for these voluntary, we call them voluntary efforts, to be remunerated, but that's a long way to come. But what we've done is negotiate with our funders to be able to reimburse their transport, to reimburse their expenses when they're coming to do this support, and give them a small little token that supports them to carry forward this effort. So in a nutshell, I'd say that peer support needs to be one of the cornerstones, one of the foundational interventions that has to be inbuilt into all the interventions that we are putting together. The training of these peer supporters must be given, because they must give the right information and be able to take it forward. Lastly, the biggest challenge for us is the dynamic environment we work in. Rapidly changing, what happened 26 years ago for relevance, TASO has to restructure itself, re-engineer itself to be relevant to today. And that happens almost on a monthly, annually, and that's some of the challenges that we are facing. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was great. I'm going to ask now, Jono and Jean, you got 1 minute to say a final comment.
I think I spoke long enough.
Okay. Any questions? We have time for two questions.
Just want to raise an issue that I think has been ignored, and that is the issue of mental health. At least in my experience with patients with HIV infection, serious mental health is 80% of the reason for not taking their drugs. And although I don't know the statistics, manic depressive syndrome is an important risk factor for acquiring HIV infection. And I think that the statutory and legislative underpinning to the management of mental health interferes with giving patients antiretrovirals or encouraging them to give antivirals. I don't have an answer, and I think it's a long discussion, but I think it's something that needs to be put into the stew of obstacles. It's one of the gaps, I guess.
I just want to...
Absolutely.
Can I do that?
Yeah.
And maybe Jane?
Yeah, no,
I think it's actually a very good point. I think many people recognize that. In the U.S. government, we have an actual agency focused on substance abuse and mental health. There's also good data that people with HIV who either drink alcohol or use drugs are much less likely to adhere to their medication, but also more likely to have risk behavior for transmission. And people who don't have HIV are more likely to have risk behavior that is traditionally associated with acquisition. The issue is, what do we do about it in that environment? Some of it is just what we already know is effective needs to be, implemented more effectively. I also think we need some evidence-based interventions so that we can actually cite that. I mean, it gives so much power to have good science behind some of these activities, gives so much power to be able to actually incorporate it into our programs. And I don't know if Diane has thoughts about that, but her whole agency is essentially focused on, or institute is focused on some of these questions. But I do think it's a place where, because we haven't spent the time doing what you've suggested, we've actually are suffering now.
And can I just add to that? And I had to go through things very quickly. One of the standards is explicitly around how people with HIV should have appropriate mental healthcare support. And we have in the UK a separate, complete set of standards for the psychological support of people living with HIV. The issue, of course, is that's there. The books are written. We've put out what we think good practice looks like. But structurally, those care services are provided out of different services by different nurses. It's very hard to join up the structure to provide it as a holistic pathway of the sort that Jane's described. So we've written extensively. And the question now is, how do we implement?
One last comment, because we have to finish.
Well, I was just going to say that we don't ignore the mental health issues. We have a research portfolio on it. We try to integrate it into the interventions. We've managed to get many, many interventions to start screening for mental health issues because it will impact adherence, and then include an adherence component to the intervention to improve adherence. But it's complicated, as everybody said, and we're plugging away, but
I want to thank everybody. We can't have more comments because there's the next session coming up. I'm sorry we didn't have enough time to go over more comments, but I appreciate the panel. Thank you very much. This was very good.